This is the New York Times Magazine for Sunday, the 22nd of September, and this is Dave Abbott. I'm going to give you as much as I can of the cover article, the feature article of this particular issue, what really caused the deadly crashes of the Boeing 737 MAX by William Languisha. I doubt if I pronounced that correctly. It's spelled Languisce. Maybe he calls it Languishy. I'm not sure. Excuse me. On October 29th, 2018, Lion Air Flight 618 taxied toward the runway at the main airport in Jakarta, Indonesia, carrying 189 people, bound for Bangka Island, a short flight away. The airplane was the latest version of the Boeing 737, a gleaming new 737 MAX that was delivered merely 3 months before. The captain was a 31-year-old Indian named Bhavya Suneja, who did his initial flight training at a small and now defunct school in San Carlos, California, and opted for an entry-level job with Lion Air in 2011. Lion Air is an aggressive airline that dominates the rapidly expanding Indonesian market in low-cost air travel and is one of Boeing's largest customers worldwide. It is known for hiring inexperienced pilots, most of them recent graduates of its own academy, and for paying them little and working them hard. Pilots like Suneja, who come from the outside, typically sign on in the hope of building hours and moving on to a better job. Lion Air gave him some simulator time and a uniform, put him in the co-pilot seat of a 737, and then made him a captain sooner than a more conventional airline would have. Nonetheless, by last October 29th, Suneja had accumulated 6,028 hours and 45 minutes of flight time. So he was no longer a neophyte. On the coming run, it would be his turn to do the flying. His co-pilot was an Indonesian, 10 years his elder, who went by the single name Harvino, that's in the Indonesian tradition, and had nearly the same flight experience. On this leg, he would handle the radio communications. No reference has been made to Harvino's initial flight training. He had accumulated about 900 hours of flight time when he was hired by Lion Air. Like thousands of new pilots now meeting the demands for crews, especially those in developing countries with rapid airline growth, his experience with flying was scripted, bounded by checklists and cockpit mandates, and depended upon autopilots. He had some rote knowledge of cockpit procedures as handed down from the big manufacturers, but he was weak in an essential quality known as airmanship. Sadly, his captain turned out to be weak in it, too. Airmanship is an anachronistic word, but it is applied without prejudice to women as well as men. Its full meaning is difficult to convey. It includes a visceral sense of navigation, an operational understanding of weather and weather information, the ability to form mental maps of traffic flows, fluency in the nuance of radio communications, and especially a deep appreciation for the interplay between energy, inertia, and wings. Airplanes are living things. The best pilots do not sit in cockpits so much as strap them on. The U.S. Navy manages to instill a sense of this in its fledgling fighter pilots by ramming them through rigorous classroom instruction and then requiring them to fly at bank angles without limits, including upside down. The same cannot be expected of airline pilots who never fly solo and whose entire experience consists of catering to passengers who flinch in mild turbulence, refer to air pockets in cocktail conversation and think they are near death if bank angles exceed 30 degrees. The problem exists for many American and European pilots, too. Unless they make extraordinary efforts, for instance, going out to fly aerobatics, fly sailplanes, or wander among the airstrips of backcountry Idaho, they may never develop true airmanship, no matter the length of their careers. The worst of them are intimidated by their airplanes and remain so until they retire or die. It is unfortunate that those who die in cockpits tend to take their passengers with them. It was a blue sky morning in Jakarta, with a few clouds floating offshore to the north. The flight was assigned a standard departure route over the Java Sea. At 6:20 a.m., it was cleared for takeoff. To anyone observing the airplane externally, for instance from the control tower, the takeoff would have appeared ordinary as the Boeing lumbered down the runway and lifted into the air. The first external hint of trouble came about a minute later after a departure controller cleared the flight for a climb to 27,000 feet. Harvino asked the controller to confirm the airplane's current altitude as shown on the controller's display. The request was unusual and it went unexplained. The controller answered that he showed the altitude as 900 feet and Harvino acknowledged him without comment as if he concurred. 25 seconds later, a long interlude in flight, Harvino requested a clearance to some holding point, that's quote, some holding point where the airplane could linger in the sky. The request was surprising. The controller did not provide a holding point, but asked about the nature of the problem. Harvino answered, flight control problem. He did not mention which kind, but before they die, pilots are rarely so descriptive. Harvino did not declare an emergency. The controller asked about their intended altitude. Harvino answered 5,000 feet, which was strangely low and to this day remains unexplained. 2.5 minutes after takeoff, as the airplane was climbing through 2,175 feet, it suddenly went into a violent 700-foot dive, rounding out of it at 1,475 feet and pulling into an uncertain climb. No turn was associated with the plunge, so the airplane's problem seemed to be unrelated to roll control and the age-old menace of a spiral dive. Right from the start of the investigation, suspicions focused on Lion Air's 610's trim mechanism, and specifically on the possibility of a failure known as a runaway trim. Trim refers to an aerodynamic condition related to pitch, the nose up or down attitude of an airplane in flight. It can be thought of as a balance point, or the nose attitude at which an airplane naturally rides when no up or down elevator control deflections are applied. That is a slight simplification, but good enough. Trim is routinely adjusted in flight. In the Boeing 737, the adjustments are made by the use of thumb switches on the control wheels when the pilots are hand-flying the airplane manually as they would on takeoff and landing. The thumb switches control an electro-hydraulic mechanism that changes the angle of the horizontal stabilizer, the all-important tail surface that counteracts the natural pitching effects of the wings and provides the necessary aerodynamic balance for flight. In its functioning, the electric trim is smooth, powerful, and usually well-behaved. On occasion, however, it may start running on its own volition and prompt the airplane to nose up or down. That is a runaway trim. Such failures are easily corrected, countered by the pilot, first by using the control column to give opposing elevator, and then by flipping a couple of switches to shut off the electrics before reverting to a perfectly capable parallel system of manual trim. But it seemed that for some reason, the Lion Air crew might not have resorted to the simple solution. Lion Air 610 climbed to 5,000 feet and stayed there shakily for an additional 6 minutes. Soon it was out over open water. At some point, Harvino declared the crew's intent to return to the Jakarta airport. Air traffic control approved the return and later advised the crew to plan on runway 25 left, the one closest to their position, but nothing occurred as a result. The airplane kept flying away from the airport. Harvino asked the controller for the airplane's speed across the ground. This was another unusual question, given that multiple independent indications of speed should have been available in the cockpit. The controller answered that the ground speed was 322 knots. That's 371 miles per hour. At that altitude, it was nearing the 737's maximum engineered aerodynamic airspeed of approximately 340 knots. The airplane was flying unusually fast. It should have been obvious to air traffic control that the pilots were struggling, but maybe because they had not declared an emergency, the controller continued to treat them routinely, repeatedly instructing them to maintain their chosen altitude of 5,000 feet and issuing multiple new compass headings to steer by. Each new heading involved a bank turn, and each bank complicated the crew's ability to keep the nose from dropping. It's hard to imagine what the controller was thinking. One of his headings steered the flight away from conflicting traffic, when instead it was the traffic that should have been steered away from the flight. Equally unfortunate was the acquiescence of Suneja and Harvino, who dutifully complied with every air traffic control request. At 6:31 a.m., 11 minutes into the flight, Suneja got on the radio for the first time. He did not know their altitude, he told the controller, because all their altitude indicators were showing different values. This is unlikely and has never been explained. Perhaps reflecting the strain he felt, Suneja misidentified himself as Lion Air 650. Appropriately, the controller acknowledged Suneja's transmission without quibbling and responded, "No restriction." He meant that Suneja was cleared to fly at whatever altitude he chose, but apparently Suneja did not understand. A few seconds later, he unnecessarily asked the controller for a block clearance to all altitudes, 3,000 feet above and below his current altitude, for traffic avoidance. The controller, who had just heard Suneja say he did not know his altitude, asked him what altitude he wanted. Suneja answered 5,000. Suneja was shepherding 188 hapless souls through the sky, 189 if you include his own, and struggling with a confusing failure of some kind. Under stress, his performance had become abysmal. Right from the start, months before the cockpit voice recorder was found and listened to, his obsession with altitude clearances could only be explained as a pilot drowning in minutiae. 5,000 was his final transmission. 12 minutes into the flight, Lion Air 610 disappeared from radar. Airline crashes are rare, and rarer still are crashes that force the grounding of an entire fleet. Lion Air 610 was not immediately among them. But about 4 months later, March 10th, 2019, an equally new 737 MAX flown by Ethiopian Airlines went down on departure from Addis Ababa with the loss of everyone aboard, and within a week, all further flights of the 737 MAX were stopped worldwide. After both accidents, the flight data recordings indicated that the immediate culprit was a sensor failure tied to a new and obscure control mechanism that was unique to the 737 MAX, the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, or MCAS. The system automatically applies double-speed impulses of nose-down trim, but only under circumstances so narrow that no regular airplane pilot will ever experience its activation unless a sensor fails. Boeing believed the system to be so innocuous, even if it malfunctioned, that the company did not inform pilots of its existence or include a description of it in the airplane's flight manuals. The system in question is complicated, and we'll return to it later, but for now it is enough to know that after the loss of Lion Air 610, the company suggested that the 737 MAX was as safe as its predecessors. Its tone was uncharacteristically meek, but not for lack of conviction. The company seemed hesitant to point the finger at a prickly customer, Lion Air, that had several billion dollars worth of orders on the table and could withdraw them at any time. The dilemma is familiar to manufacturers after major accidents in which it is usually some pilot and not an airplane that has gone wrong. Nonetheless, Boeing's reticence to allow a narrative to emerge that the company had developed the system to elude regulators, that it was all about shortcuts and greed, that it had cynically gambled with the lives of the flying public, that the Lion Air pilots were overwhelmed by the failures of a hidden system that could not reasonably have been expected to resist, and that the design of the MCAS was unquestionably the cause of the accident. But none of that is quite true. The rush to lay blame was based in part on a poor understanding not just of the technicalities, but also of Boeing's commercial aviation culture. The MAX's creation took place in suburban Seattle among engineers and pilots of unquestionable, if bland, integrity, including supervising officials from the FAA. Although Boeing's designers were aware of timetables and competitive pressures, the mistakes they made were honest ones, or stupid ones, or maybe careless ones, but not as a result of an intentional sacrifice of safety for gain. As always, there was a problem with like-mindedness and a reluctance by team players to stand out from the crowd. Even more pernicious was the FAA's long-standing delegation of regulatory authority to Boeing employees, a worry that is perennially available to chew on, if you like, and may indeed be related to the configuration of the troublesome system as it was installed. Nonetheless, in Seattle, at the level where such small choices are made, corruption, like cynicism, is rare. That is not to be meant as a blanket defense of Boeing. On the corporate level, the company is the worst sort of player. A corrosive agent that spreads money around Washington, pushes exotic weapons on Congress, toys with nuclear annihilation, sells all sorts of lesser instruments of death to oppressive regimes around the world, and dangerously distorts American society in the ways that President Dwight D. Eisenhower warned against in his prescient 1961 farewell address. But hardly any of that matters in the story of the 737 MAX. What sent an expensive new Boeing airplane into the ocean on that beautiful, bright morning in Indonesia, it's understandable to look for a simple answer. Laying the blame on a poorly implemented system, even a complex one, made the accident relatively easy to understand and also provided for a material solution. Simply fix the system. But the focus on a single shoddy component, as the news media and government regulators have rushed to do, has obscured the larger forces that ultimately made these accidents possible. The paradox is that the failures of the 737 MAX were really the product of an incredible success, a decades-long transformation of the whole business of flying in which airplanes became so automated and accidents so rare that a cheap air travel boom was able to take root around the world. Along the way, though, this system never managed to fully account for the unexpected, for the moment when technology fails, and humans, a growing population of more than 300,000 airline pilots of variable and largely unpredictable skills, are required to intervene. In the drama of the 737 MAX, it was the decisions made by four of these pilots, more than the failure of a single obscure component, that led to 346 deaths and the worldwide grounding of the entire fleet. If you were to choose a location in the developing world in which to witness the challenges facing airline safety, the ossification of regs, and in many places their creeping irrelevance to operations, the corruption of government inspectors, the corruption of political leaders and the press, the pressure on mechanics, dispatchers, and flight crews to keep unsafe airplanes in the air, the discouragement, fatigue, low wages of many airline employees, the willingness of bankers and insurers to underwrite bare-bones operations at whatever risk to the public, the cynicism of investors who insist on treating air travel as just another business opportunity, and finally, the eagerness of the manufacturers to sell their airplanes to any airline without restraint. You'd be hard-pressed to find a more significant place than Indonesia. The country began deregulating its airline industry in the late 1990s in the hope of providing for the sort of fast, low-cost travel that might bind its islands together. No-frills newcomers who cared nothing for prestige rushed in to compete for the business of bargain-conscious passengers and undercut the flagship national airline, Garuda, in a booming domestic market that started growing at a rate second only to China's. The free-for-all soon raised questions about how to manage safety. That's a polite way of putting it. A race to the bottom comes to mind. At the forefront of the boom was a streetwise Jakarta local named Rosdi Kirana, then 36, who came from a humble background, once sold typewriters for a living, and became an airport freelancer hustling for scraps of opportunity among the passengers moving through the terminal buildings. Initially, that meant wheeling suitcases to and from the curb, holding up name signs in the arrival flows, or spotting people who might appreciate some friendly guidance. He was good at the hustle, but little else has been reported about his early work at the airport, except that in the 1990s, he and his brother started what they called a travel agency. This was in a pre-electronic era when the airlines issued paper tickets. In Jakarta, the airport terminals had become marketplaces where thousands of passengers in search of cheap flights hunted for last-minute discounts offered by airlines wanting to fill empty seats at any price. Kirana and his brother stepped in as middlemen, acquiring tickets by the fistful from airline clerks and scalping them to the crowds. The mechanics of the scheme remained murky, but even Garuda profited from Kirana's hustle. No one complained. Kirana's travel agency did not make him rich, but it apparently convinced him that a large, unexploited market existed in Indonesia for cheap flights, and that someday, because of the country's island geography, air travel might be seen as routine by ordinary people. At the time, the industry remained regulated. Kirana seemed to believe that it was price rather than convenience that counted, and that the trips would have cost about the same as those by ferry and bus. To achieve that, he would have to use his own airplanes and control every aspect of the operation. More important than reducing costs, he would have to fill his airplanes to capacity and keep them flying. He would call the airline Lion Air. To save money, he sketched out the logo and uniforms himself. He approached the transportation ministry to inquire about licensing the airline and was laughed off and advised to set up a condom factory instead. But when the industry was deregulated shortly afterward, Kirana could not be denied. He leased a decrepit Boeing 737, and in June 2000, Lion Air started operations offering low-cost flights on two of Indonesia's most popular routes. Within 5 years, domestic passenger traffic doubled and then tripled. Lion Air's fleet grew by even larger multiples as the airline gobbled up an increasing share of the market, and Kirana turned out to be a master of financial dealings. The public flocked to him, even while reviling his airline for its poor on-time performance, and soon enough for its safety record. He did not appear to care about the complaints that came in. One afternoon, he pointed to a trash can in his office and said to a businessman I know, "Here is my complaints department." People called him ruthless, but shrewd is a better description. Having given up at typewriter sales, he was determined to succeed at something else. He told the businessman that it is a mistake in an airline venture to get wrapped up in the romance and art of flying because money is what counts. He may have been right, except that this approach reduces pilots to journeymen and ignores the role of airmanship in safety. The twist is that Kirana could have built his airline on the Airbus A320, an airplane that is less challenging to fly, but instead chose the equivalent Boeing 737, which counts on pilots as the last resort if something mechanical or otherwise goes wrong. I've been unable to speak to Kirana despite multiple attempts to reach him, so I do not know if he cares about these distinctions. For sure, though, he cares that once an airline makes a choice between Airbus and Boeing, changing manufacturers is expensive to do. Simulators, shop equipment, stocks of spare parts, and training curricula have to change. Kirana has become a major Airbus customer, but for other airlines he now controls. As for Lion Air, having begun with Boeing, it stuck with Boeing, and by 2005 placed an order for up to 60 next-generation 737-900ERs. ER stands for extended range. The 900 is a 220-passenger airplane. The model was unpopular and had garnered not a single customer before Lion Air came along. The deal came close to $4 billion, and this got Boeing's attention. The deregulated Indonesian airline industry was also attracting attention, but not of the desirable kind. Accompanying the drastic expansion in traffic was a disproportionate rise in accidents. There were many contributing factors, mostly among the budget carriers, but affecting Garuda as well. An onrush of inexperienced pilots willing to work long hours for low pay, discouragement among mechanics, ramp workers, and dispatchers, pressure to keep airplanes flying despite component failures that should have grounded them, the falsification of cargo, passenger manifests, dual maintenance and flight logs, and corruption permeating the entire system, including even air traffic control. In Jakarta, a graybeard captain, speaking to me on the condition of anonymity, described the attitude of the new owners toward their pilots. He said, "The pilots passed the check ride. They can fly the airplanes." Also, in some owners' view, the semi-annual simulator training is wasteful because the simulators are costly to run and maintain, and while the pilots are playing around in them while collecting their pay, they are not out producing revenue. Normally, two pilots train in a simulator at a time with an instructor seated behind them, so three in the box. I was told that in Indonesian simulators there are sometimes seven in there, two pilots flying, one instructing, and four others standing up and logging the time. One Indonesian newcomer was a low-cost airline called Adam Air, which was a Lion Air competitor for several years. Its disregard of safety ran the gamut and resulted in the dispatch of shabby airplanes in the hands of beleaguered pilots. Former Adam Air employees could not be reached for comment. Many pilots quit out of disgust or fear. I know how it feels because as a young man I flew for fly-by-night cargo operators in the U.S. and suffered most of the survivable failures known to pilot kind. Engine failure, engine fire, electrical fire, radio failure, radar failure, pressurization failure, wing flap failure, landing gear failure, gyroscopic failure, airspeed indication failure, altimeter failure, anti-ice failure, personal girlfriend failure, tail fin canning lightning strike failure, and trim failures at least four times. By trim failures, I mean runaway trims. Our mechanics laughed about pencil whipping the airplanes into the air, and we agreed that the paperwork was a joke. The FAA inspected it and never caught on. But we carried only freight. One winter night, one of our pilots died. He was taken down by a de-icing failure over high terrain inbound to L.A., and none of us were surprised. But Adam Air carried unwitting passengers. Its president director was a wealthy young man named Adam Suherman, who lived in Los Angeles for a few years. One day he went back to Jakarta and with the help of family money started an airline. It began flying December 2003. One of its 737s, an airplane that had been around for the block for 18 years and was leased from Wells Fargo, was written up by pilots for recurring defects 154 times over the final 3 months of 2006. The number was high because the defects were not fixed. By far the largest number of defects was related to discrepancies between the airplane's two independent inertial reference systems, navigational and flight instrumentation, drivers that are important to the safe completion of a flight. And unfortunately, I cannot complete this flight today. This is Dave Abbott. This has been the New York Times Magazine. Thanks so much for listening.